I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
all right. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers. Welcome back to Stages. Luke Joslin is a graduate of the University of Western Sydney and the Actors College of Theatre and Television. Luke has forged a successful career in both musical theatre and straight drama, as well as being highly sought after as a director. Luke worked as an actor for 15 years, and his extensive resume includes the national tour of Peter Pan Goes Wrong, The Play That Goes Wrong, Annie, the 25th anniversary production of Les Miserables, and Avenue Q. As a director for the theatre, his credits include Annie, Educating Rita, Songs for a New World, In the Heights, and Bells Are Ringing. He presently helms the exciting new production of Grease, which has made its way to Sydney, following a triumphant season in Melbourne. And the next stop is Perth. Luke Joslin joined Stages to reflect on his journey from actor to director and why Grease is still the word. Luke Joslin, welcome to the Stages podcast.
Oh, thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
After long last.
Yeah.
Now, look, Grease is the musical that you are presently directing.
Yes.
For Crossroads Live.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a staple of the musical theatre for several decades.
Mm.
In fact, it premiered on Broadway in 1972.
Mm.
Why is Grease still the word?
It's a timeless piece. You know, it goes round and round. I mean, obviously it had enormous appeal in Australia because of the film. We had, you know, we had Olivia, we had John. The music is infectious. You know, it's great. They're great 50s rock and roll tunes. But I guess to boil it down, it really comes down to accessibility. It's a great sort of, you know, boy and girl love story. It's something we can all identify with. That's why it's got legs. I mean, that's a fairly cliched answer. It's kind of a boring answer, I guess. But it's like, it's thematically, it holds up. It's got global appeal because it's timeless.
Mm.
And we can still identify with it in 2024, you know. But it's also that nostalgia that, you know, that allows an audience to tap into. We tap into our inner nostalgia, and we get to sit back and we get to just enjoy this great love story about a time that was simpler, and, you know, coupled with great infectious rock and roll tunes, and it's a recipe for longevity. It's a recipe for timelessness. It just goes on and on and on, and it will continue, I believe. It will continue to live on and on. You know, I mean, it sort of did big business here in Australia and continues to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just lost Olivia Newton-John not long ago, sadly. Mm-hmm. You know, that was very tragic. But you know, she was our Aussie sweetheart.
Yeah.
You know, and she was in Grease. And we love that movie. We love it.
And in fact, they changed Sandy, didn't they, in the film to make her an Aussie sweetheart. Because she's not in the original.
No. Correct. So it seemed to really work.
Mm.
You know, particularly with the bad boy Danny, you know, it's the gang leader. There was something about making her Australian that seemed to tap into an innocence that perhaps wasn't there before, that made, you know, made that story even more juxtaposed, I guess. You know, the sort of bringing them together was very sort of Shakespearean, sort of Romeo and Juliet-esque. You know, they were like, they couldn't be together, but but they got together in the end, and I guess they each taught something to the other person that perhaps wasn't there before, which is great.
You're quite right about nostalgia. When it was written in the 70s, there was a nostalgia for the 50s. In 2024, it's fascinating that we still have that nostalgia. And I guess it's to do with, we've all been to high school. We've all had those relationships over the summer.
We all know a Rizzo.
We all know a Kinnicky.
We all know a Doody and a Sonny. We all know these types of characters. We went to school with them. You know, we love them. We hate them. Perhaps some of us got bullied by these types of people. Perhaps we didn't. Perhaps we were friends with them. Perhaps we were those people. I don't know, but it continues to live on because it's highly identifiable still.
Themes of love and friendship, teenage rebellions,
absolutely,
sexual exploration,
absolutely, gang culture, car culture. And I've had it said to me many times, Peter, that it is that. That's why I sort of said that nostalgia thing, because, you know, when you're sitting in the auditorium over however many previews, I tend to sort of just check in with what's going on around me. Listen to that conversation, tune into that one.
Of course.
And, you know, quite often it's, you know, this takes me back. Takes me back to a better time. And then, you know, by the end of the show, everyone's on their feet and you've got tradies, you've got, you know, all walks of life there. They know the words. They sing the words. They mouth the words. It's great. I mean, it's, where else would you get that?
Yeah.
So it surprises me. It does. I think I said that to you earlier. It surprises me that it just continues to live on in this big way even today.
Well, Greece for 2024, it has been identified as perhaps a problematic show to be doing nowadays, because of, you know, Rizzo's slut shaming, and there's a few lines which are detrimental to females. Sandy has to sort of effectively become a bad girl to win the boy at the end. How do you address those issues in a production in 2024?
Yeah, it's difficult, and of course when it came to me, you couldn't help but think, wow, is this going to be a poison chalice moment? Is this going to be something that ends this career ending? Is this the end? It's all over from here.
You're a brave man.
But I guess, you know, you take it, you embrace it, you sit in the world and you think, okay, yes, there is some problematic stuff in this show. And how do we navigate around that? Well, we looked at, you know, every iteration of Grease over the years has, I would argue, has been increasingly watered down for that reason. Well, perhaps not for that reason. Perhaps, you know, because some of that 50s referencing no longer really holds up, and, I mean, people sort of can't identify with it. What I opted to do was, and this is the beauty about Grease, is that you can sort of take it for what it is. There are multiple iterations, and you can manipulate it a little and sort of create your own version. Yes, it is still Grease. It's still the same script, but you're able to structure it, restructure it in places that perhaps you can't do with other shows. And we've got, you know, great orchestration there. We're able to play a little with orchestration. We were able to play with new choreography because this was a brand new production. This is not a production that is pre-existing. So I guess for me, in answer to your question, it was about looking at some of those lines, those specific lines that were jarring, having a bit of a rethink about, you know, can we take a word out? Can we just change the emphasis here and there? But also tone, the actor tone was a very big one as well. And how we cast the show really informed that as well. You know, we wanted to make sure that we cast people, particularly the Danny track, particularly the Kinnicky track, that yes, they're tough guys, but they're kind of likable and lovable, and they're a bit flawed themselves.
Yeah.
They don't quite perhaps have the intelligence to pull it off yet. Whereas Sandy is a slightly, you know, she's sort of a little bit more got it together, and she's sort of she waves the finger at Danny quite often through the show. You know, there's a moment where she does give him a good old slap in the face. In other words, don't you talk to me like that. Who do you think you are? You know. So I guess, you know, but you've got to write a fine line, Peter, because you can't, you know, you can't go down a road that is unidentifiable because the bulk of the audience go to see the story that they know and love.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's treading that fine line. But I think we've succeeded to some degree. There's always going to be problems. There's always going to be problems. But we've certainly done our best to acknowledge those and to you know, navigate around them as best we can.
Well, in my research, Jim Jacobs, who wrote the music and lyrics for the show, describes the show's basic plot as a subversion of common tropes of 1950s cinema. Mm. Since the female lead, who is in many 1950s films, if we think about those Doris Day films, transformed the alpha male into a more sensitive and sympathetic character. So he's subverting that with Grease. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, you know, and it's something that, you know, I mean, I've been in conversations with the production because I'm obviously up here and the production is playing in Melbourne. And it's something you've got to monitor because it is easy as an actor to sort of fall into what we know. And this is the danger with a show that's so well known is that, you know, it's like doing Les Mis. I mean, it's, you know, people... Actors that get cast in Les Mis, well, what do they want to do? They want to play Les Mis. They want to play Javert.
Yeah.
It's like, well, yes, that's great. But in order to make it our own, we have to unpick and undo all of that. Clean slate, start again, build upon it, and make the character your own. In other words, it's the actor playing the character. You bring yourself through the character, and you know, the less you layer it on, you know, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, the less sort of offensive it can become, you know what I mean? Because you're bringing yourself through it. And the guy that we've got playing Danny, for example, is a lovely fella, Joe Spanty, terrific, and a really nice guy, you know, and that shines through, you know. So it does soften.
Yeah.
It does soften the blow a little.
Charisma.
Let's go with that. Yeah. Charisma.
Look, well, Grease is a musical that we've seen many, many times in Australia. If you're of a certain age, you remember certain productions. You know, John Frost at Crossroads Live when he was at GFO, Gordon Frost Organisation. Famous production at the Footbridge, which starred Guy Pearce as Danny Zuko. And then a spectacular arena version of the show. And of course... Originally, the original Australian production was in 1972, the same year that it premiered on Broadway. Harry M. Miller, the great impresario, got the show and produced it at the Metro Theatre in Melbourne.
Yeah.
With a stellar cast who obviously went on to become, you know, the leaders of the industry.
Yeah, that's right.
David Atkins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tina Bursell.
Yeah.
Ron Chaloner. John Dietrich.
Yeah.
Denise Drysdale.
Yeah. What did John Dietrich play?
John Dietrich played...
Roger.
Roger. Yes, what about that?
Wow, there you go.
Chris McQuaid, John McTiernan.
Wow.
Natalie Mosco. Ross Coleman was the choreographer.
There you go.
Gary
Jonathan, Downer. And directed by Jonathan Banks.
Mike Ehrmanhardt from Breaking Bad.
That's right. That's right. Tina Bursell, who, God love, I mean, I love Tina Bursell, tells a great story about Jonathan Banks walking around. I don't know whether he directed it much.
He must have been the resident director of the tour or something.
But he
America.
Was sort of, you know, he'd walk around and give notes while he had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, you know, a very different time. But, yeah, I mean, there's some showbiz royalty on that list.
I've never seen a cast like it.
Yeah.
They all did Grease in
rite of passage, isn't it?
Sal Shirar too, I think.
Oh, you know? Sal Shirar.
Yeah, yeah. So,
there you go.
Great. Right. So, of course, the film with Travolta and Newton John had a lot of new musical numbers written for it.
Yeah.
And very smartly, the production of Grease is now has that within because I guess people go and they want to hear You're the One That I Want and Sandy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they've adopted those tunes and. We're very faithful to those. I mean, in our production particularly, we're very faithful to those. We've got a musical supervisor, MD, David Skelton, who is just, you know, I mean, fantastic rock and roll mind and has done some wonderful things with those tunes. And, they really pop and sing, you know, they're fantastic. So we're very much, you know, we're very, very faithful to it. I think people leave very satisfied, I think. Particularly with the songs. Rizzo, particularly in Act 2, with There Are Worse Things I Could Do, is just Yeah, really great.
Do you ever see Grease 2 with Michelle Pfeiffer?
You know what? I think I probably have, but I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember. Perhaps I put it out of my mind.
Mm.
Have you seen The Pink Ladies?
No, that's a new TV series on Netflix.
Yeah, I had a go at that, and interesting. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. But just goes to show you. I mean, you know, even that alone, making something like Pink Ladies. I mean, I guess Netflix created it. I mean, they're not going to create something that they don't believe has legs and has appeal. So, I mean, it lives on. Continues to live on.
Yeah. They'll find a strong... Oh, it's like Wednesday Addams too.
Yeah.
That series recently, the spin-off from the Addams Family. You've got a great cast, of course. You talk about Joe and Annalise playing Sandy.
Indeed, yeah.
But some legends of the Australian theatre industry. Great to see Paddy Newton.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's fantastic. Paddy Newton, yeah.
And Marsha Hines as Teen Angel. That's an inspired... choice.
Yeah. To do that too. I mean, Marsha is, you know, she's just... Well, it just breathes a new life into that number, you know, particularly where it comes in the show, which is partway through Act Two, and what it does is, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that the show necessarily needs that. Perhaps it does, but it does give it a lift, and the fact that it is Marsha, it becomes a rock concert for a good 3 or 4 minutes, starring Marsha Hines, and she just embraces it.
Well, it's a great cameo for a star performer, isn't it? You know, we've seen Todd McKinney, Anthony Warlow.
Yeah, that's right.
I think Burt's done it.
Correct. They've all had a go.
John Farnham might have done it.
Yeah, John Farnham may have done it. I don't. I can remember Anthony's version, Todd's version.
Yeah.
Burt was Vince Fontaine. I know Burt played Vince Fontaine in the 2014 production. So it's lovely that Paddy.
Yes, it's a lovely...
has come and joined us now. Serendipity. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And there's a beautiful... Even now, there's this unbreakable bond between her and Bert. Even now, it's a wonderful thing to just sit there and listen to her.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Mm. But we're very lucky. And Jay Lagaya, of course, you know, who's become a dear mate of mine over the years. And
great.
So it's wonderful to have him there. And it was a joy. It was hard.
Mm.
Was hard and fast because it was new, you know, and when it was put to us that we were going to do this new production and we had X amount of time, we knew that we had to run, not walk, we had to run. Mm. And at times it was difficult, but we got there. I mean, we were forever grateful. I mean, I'm forever grateful. I mean, you know, Frosty asked me to do it and he didn't have to.
No.
So... I'll be forever grateful for that. I don't know whether I'll get asked to do another one, but who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe.
I'm sure he's very happy.
Yeah, he seems to be. So that's the main thing, I guess.
Good. As part of your research, I guess you've been submerged in music from the 50s.
Indeed.
What's a genre that you listen to usually for pleasure?
That's a good question, actually, because I do listen to a whole range of things.
Well, when in the theatre, I guess, show tunes
Not really.
No.
If I was to be honest. I mean, you'd think so. Well, it is work, and you'd think so. I remember having this similar, very same chat to Wayne Scott Kermode many years ago. In fact, it stayed with me because I think I asked Wayne the same thing. I said, Wayne, you know, do you go home and listen to it? He said, no. Listen to show tunes. You'd be joking. Listen to show tunes. That's work. He probably doesn't remember saying that. If he's listening to this, he probably doesn't remember saying that. But he did. I remember very clearly him saying that. And I guess I'm not dissimilar in the sense that if it's a show that I'm working on or been asked to do, of course I'm aware of it and I would have heard it at some point. But then I'll sort of deep dive. And but I don't tend to sort of sit around and listen to show tunes. I am a big Sinatra fan though.
Oh,
If I'm looking to put something on, it'll probably be a Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis. You know, all the Sands, the Rat Pack stuff is what I would probably tend to go to. Interestingly,
did cast recordings figure in the household as a kid? I mean,
not really. No. I mean, I didn't grow up in a showbiz family at all. My sister was a good singer. She treaded the boards, and I guess because I did, and so we sort of both fell into it.
She went in community theatre?
Yeah, you know, we sort of started in community theatre and she went another way and I went the other way. But we weren't really ever encouraged or we were just... What we were encouraged is we were encouraged to do what we wanted to do. Mm. There was no pressure to do one thing or another. So we were very lucky in that sense. But I guess growing up, yeah, no, although, you know, I can remember what... And I often tell this story that it was Rob... It was the late Rob Guest that really, really... made me sort of stand up and take notice, I guess, because I was just captivated by him. Whenever I would see a performance with Rob in it, I was just captivated. And it was something about the rawness and the you know, he was not necessarily refined, but he was in it. He was always in it fully. And even as a young kid, I remember watching it and just going, wow, that's something else, you know. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I often tell that story that he was the main reason I sort of really started to pursue it, I guess. I was really fascinated by, you know, the roles. And I'd go to shows by myself that he was in. You know, I can remember going to see Jolson and The Music Man you know, Sound of Music and Phantom multiple times and Les Mis and, you know, he was... Just one of those performers I really sort of
clicked with.
Yeah,
that charisma.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet him or work with him?
I was at the Theatre Royal seeing Phantom for probably the sixth time, and I remember I was in a shop not far from the theatre, and he walked in with his mask on, full kit. Clothes were, you know, he had his own clothes on, but he was obviously
between shows.
Right, it was a between show moment, and I just remember thinking, my Lord, you know, like, it's Rob Guest, you know. Now I didn't meet him that day, but I did meet him some years later when we went to see a show. I went to see a friend in a show at Penrith Panthers in the Evan Theatre of all places, and Kelly, late Kelly Dickerson, and Rob both turned up together, and I sat next to Rob, and he had a terrible back problem. He was complaining about the seat and the chair, and I sat next to him, and we had a little bit of a conversation, but I was totally starstruck, yeah, you know, yeah. I was in awe of this. But again, as you said, it was charisma. It was this charisma that he had that just, I sparked something within me, I guess.
What was the shop that you were in that he came into? Was he just getting a pie?
It was a coffee shop. And I guess when you came out of stage door at the Theatre Royal and you turned right, there was a food court in there. You know, it was that little... And it was a little coffee shop in there. I mean, it wasn't too far from stage door. I mean, you wouldn't be wandering around in full makeup, I guess, around the city people.
That's what I was thinking.
But he was just in and around the corner. So he'd obviously popped out, grabbed his coffee and went back.
I suppose he had his mask on too, because otherwise it's that hideous makeup.
Yeah, well, no, he didn't. He had just the makeup on. So the mask was off, but he had the makeup. The hair was done. The hair was slicked back and he was fully done. And it was one of those moments I will never forget.
Yeah. Well, there's a performer. What was the first show that you saw that really sparked an interest in being a performer? Or seduced you to run away and join the circus?
There was many. I mean, I was a mad drama student at school.
Right.
And I was forever writing skits. You know, I was always in the drama staff room writing skits and putting little plays on at the talent quest and writing things. And I was always doing comedy and impersonating the teachers.
Class clown?
Class clown. Yeah. Absolute class clown, which is how I used to get out of trouble. I mean, you know, if you were at high school, particularly the high school I went to, if you were good at something, irrespective of whether it was the dramatic arts or whether it was, you know, I mean, preferably football. Mm. But if you did drama, but you were good at it, you were safe. But if you did drama and you weren't that good at it, you know, so you'd sort of, and that'd show up in the shows because the footy players had come to the shows and they'd see you sort of floundering on the edges, then you'd cop it.
Yeah.
But I was lucky because I can remember walking through the school ground, and this particular student who was he's a bit of a thug, and he was the sort of he ran the playground, called me over, Luke, come over here, do that teacher, impersonate that teacher, do it. And I'm thinking, okay, so I did the impersonation, Oh, how fun is that? You know, now piss off. Now get bugger off. You know, but
if you can make someone laugh. Yeah,
and all the group laughed, thought it was great. Oh, wow, that's a really good impersonation. You really nailed him. Safe. I was safe.
Yeah.
So funny, isn't it, when you think about it? But I knew it. I knew if I just played that hand and just continued to be the funny guy, then you sort of got through. And I had a great schooling. I mean, I was very lucky in that sense that I sort of went through. And then it got to the stage where, you know, people start to take you seriously. Oh, he's doing this for real.
Yeah, right. Yes, in history, I suppose that's the role of the court jester.
Yes. It
kept the court jester alive. In true. Could,
that's right.
Amuse the king.
Indeed. Yeah. So I was very lucky in that sense. But I guess first show experience, look, what I can remember is that very, very early Phantom being one of those experiences that really... and it was everything about it. It wasn't just, you know, I mean, yes, Rob was in it. I remember Rob was in it. I think it was John Bowles. John Bowles.
As
Danielle Everett.
Yep.
Marie Johnson, perhaps around that time.
Yep.
But it was everything. It was the staging, the lighting, the way the set moved. It just was just captivating. You know.
A younger generation, you tell those stories about that Phantom and Les Mis when they first arrived. Yeah. I mean, we'd seen nothing like them.
No.
I mean, no. Those sets were extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
The stars of the show, really.
You know, when he appeared above the prosage at the top, you know, it was just, everything about it was just thrilling.
Well, directed by Hal Prince, of course, and then Les Mis by Trevor Nunn, giants of the directing world.
Yeah.
I read that you wanted to be a vet when you were at school.
Yeah, I did. I went to... I did.
Work experience.
Well, I love animals, Peter. I do. I love animals. I've got a pet parrot who sits on my... head. Well, he's very tame. He's nice to me, but he bites everyone else.
Does he speak?
No, he doesn't speak yet.
Right.
But...
How old is he?
He's a couple of years.
Right. So he's not speaking yet.
You'd think he'd be speaking by now. Yeah. But he's very moody. He's very moody, and he doesn't get a certain amount of sleep. You know, he gets very... Anyway, I'm going off track. But he's very tame, and he sort of, you know, he climbs a lot. So I love animals. I've always loved animals. And so I thought it'd be a good idea to go and do work experience at a vet. And because I loved animals, I thought, well, this is great. I mean, this is the perfect fit. I'm going to be a vet. And I was in year 9, 10, I can't remember. I went along and did a work experience at a veterinary surgeon, and that was, I thought, no, this is not for me. You know, I can remember seeing an Alsatian in a cage attack a vet. That vet had to be taken to hospital. But there were people coming in with sick dogs, and it was like part of the family, and having to put the dog down, and it was all so traumatic. And then there was another story where we went out to this farm, and this bull was in a crush, which is this device to keep a bull steady. And it had an orange stuck in its esophagus. And so, you know, what are we going to use? You know, there's no... we'll get a piece of pipe down the throat, dislodging the... I thought, hang on a minute, this is not for me.
No.
I mean, I love animals and all, but this is stretched too far.
Yes.
So that was off the table very quickly. Yeah.
But actors, animals, there's not a lot of difference, really.
No, that's true. That's true, yeah.
So we jest, of course, our actors, friends listening. So obviously you need to go off and train. You're at the University of Western Sydney and the Actors College of Theatre and Television.
Yeah, that was terrific. It was, University of Western Sydney was a great time, a long time ago now, but... The Actors College of Theatre and Television, when it was called that, I think it's now changed, it's something different. But it was a great... That was a year of full-time study, and it was a great time. You know, I recall being part of a class of, you know, and I guess a lot of those students that were in that class, they were great, but they weren't really... I can recall going... They were just looking around thinking, not really taking this very seriously, you know. Some of them were, but some of them didn't. And I guess you get out what you put in to that sort of training. And I linked up with some great tutors, Sean O'Riordan, and a number of really wonderful tutors that really assisted me and gave me great advice and foundation. And that was a great time, yeah. It was a long time ago. But yeah, I learn a lot in that time, and then working in a theatre, I learn a lot too. You know, because I've always worked in a theatre.
Yeah.
To some degree, I've been a flyman, I've been a stage door person, I've been an usher, I've been a front of house manager, I've been all of these things in and around
perspectives.
In and around the production, so that when you direct something, you know, you can come at it from that point of view. You're very, very well aware of what other people
are doing
and going through. So that sort of training, I liken it to training and observing over a long period of time. I mean, I've been at Parramatta Riverside Theatre for forever, 15 years, on and off.
Yeah.
And under Robert Love and now Craig McMaster and...
Doing front of house or
Well, a bit of everything. Yeah, I mean, back of house, stage door, primarily front of house towards the back end of that. But yeah, you get to see every kind of show.
Right, yeah.
And you watch and you learn and you listen and you absorb as much as you can. And I it was a great training ground, a great training ground to be able to meet who you meet and just see show after show after show after show. And knowing how they're all pulled together by talking to the different departments and the back of house crew. And so it's very beneficial to have had that experience.
So what was the first pro gig that you scored? What were you?
That was Dirty Dancing.
Oh, was it? That
in 2000.
Geez, very early 2000s, wasn't it?
20 years ago.
Yeah. Wow.
20 years ago. I remember where I was. Yeah. I remember where I was. And I auditioned for that at ABC.
You had an
ABC.
Agent by then, I guess, didn't you?
I did. I had an agent. June Riley was my agent.
Right.
And... I remember getting the call. I just remember it so well, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. You're in
show. Believe that I was in, that I'd been cast in a show.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I was a copywriter at that point. I was working for Jerry Harvey as a copywriter in the advertising department.
Right.
Because I had an interest in, I had many interests, jack of all trades, master of none, but I had an interest in broadcast journalism and writing so I was working as a copywriter at the time, and I got this gig, and then I had to resign really quickly. I'm going on tour. Going to showbiz. And that was a wonderful show to step into as a first show, because it was a brand new production. So this was not something that was pre-existing. This was... we were starting afresh. I mean, of course, it was Dirty Dancing. We all know the movie, but Mark Wing Davey was brought on to direct, and great. Like, even then, I remember looking at Mark and going, "Wow, this guy's fantastic." And he didn't last with the production for whatever reason, but I certainly appreciated him. And there was a Revolve, and there was a Winnebago. They called it a Winnebago, which was a massive projector screen that would up and down and back and forth. And it was enormous. It was enormous. But it was great. And, of course, who you're working with in the show was... you're working with some of the greats.
Well, you probably, as a young fella, probably didn't realise at the time who those greats were.
No.
I mean, Rod Dunbar.
Yes.
Ernie Bourne.
Ronnie Arnold. Yeah. Russell Newman.
Yeah.
Leonie Page.
Yeah.
Helen Bidet.
Mm.
Tony Kogan.
Yeah.
The list goes on and on, It was a masterclass everywhere you turned. And I mean, I was very lucky, Peter, to play an old woman at the end of the show.
All right.
This was part of my track,
but
I wouldn't have given it up for anything. I get to dress in this beautiful wig and this. I was like an old lady with Ernie Bourne. So Ernie Bourne and I would dress up as the two old ladies at the end of the show. And honest to God, it was just, to sit that close to someone like Ernie Bourne over however many months, maybe a year, maybe more, to watch that. I mean, it's like masterclass in comedy. And Rod Dunbar as well. They both, because they would alternate. Right. And it was wonderful for me to be there and to be part of that.
So you had the time of your life.
I did.
I think the first time I saw you on stage was the play That Goes Wrong.
Oh, yeah.
incredibly physical, funny, funny play, you know, which made fun of all those things that can go wrong in the theatre.
Yep, that's true.
Tough to rehearse that, the blocking and all that sort of thing.
It was very, very tough, very tough. It's one of the hardest things I think I've ever done. People would say, I lost a lot of weight on that show. I mean, I would just sweat. Injury. I mean, it was, even today, that's not true. This right arm still suffers from a little bit of avenicuitis.
Oh, which we'll talk about
which
that.
Which was the puppetry that did that. But this play, extremely physical. There were stages that would drop and desks and filing cabinets that would roll forward and you would literally have to stop them from falling off the stage. And you do that with your body weight. People say, wow, that was really clever. How did that happen? No. There's no tricks. That's exactly what it is. It's a desk and a filing cabinet coming towards you and you've got to do your best to counter it. And but it was the laughter was quite remarkable. Like, I've never been part of something where the laughter would just, the people would be in the aisles laughing. I mean, it was incredibly funny, incredibly clever. And it was great. It was a great time.
Well, it spawned a whole lot of follow-on shows, wasn't it? Peter Pan that
we
goes wrong.
We did Peter Pan and... Goes Wrong, which I went on to, and I was the resident director on that show as well. That was great. Fastest revolve ever. World record for the fastest revolve, and I'm hanging onto the side of the revolve going round and round and round and round. So it had its challenges, you know, physical challenges, very physical, particularly today and particularly with this sort of comedy as well, that audiences are funny because unless you're bleeding, you know, they're kind of not satisfied. So you really have to thrust yourself into it in order to even get a laugh. But the play That Goes Wrong particularly was very, very clever.
So what can go wrong in the play That Goes Wrong?
Well, it's the Cornley Polytechnic Amateur Dramatic Society putting on the murder at Havisham Manor. So everybody is taking it very seriously. This is the night of nights. And nothing is going to go wrong tonight. We've rehearsed it. It's ready to go, ready to roll out. So, of course, you know, we go out into the auditorium before the show and we meet the audience, you know, because that's what you do. You know, I've got my name badge on, I'm the vice president, and Chris is the president, and we go out and we meet and greet the audience and then we start the show. And from the word go, everything just starts to unravel. It's very subtle at the beginning, but then it sort of snowballs and becomes increasingly more insane. And it's just everything that we, you know, lights coming up at the wrong time, props falling over when least expect. I mean, actors finding themselves in situations that, because the show must go on.
Yeah.
So this is the mantra. That's so it must go on. So no matter what it took for the show to continue and to keep moving forward, we would make that happen. Mm. You would acknowledge it, the problem, but then you'd recover very quickly and just continue. And that was funny in itself because you, from the audience perspective, you were watching a bunch of people flounder for 2.5 hours and try to somehow pull it together. And I guess there's nothing more satisfying for an audience to see people just dying on stage.
Absolutely.
But it was a ball. It was hard work, though. Wow, it was hard work.
What about Avenue Q? Had you worked with puppets before?
Never worked with puppets, but went into the audition knowing that I didn't work with puppets, but for some reason, when I picked up the puppet, true story, in the audition, we had a puppet coordinator there who said, oh, you've worked with puppets before. I said, no, I've never worked with puppets. She said, yes, you have. I said, no, I haven't. She said, okay. Well, that surprises me. Said, you've just got a natural ability to be able to manipulate the puppet.
We were a big fan of the Muppet Show, I'm just thinking.
Osmosis. I certainly grew up with the Muppet Show.
Yeah.
Talking something that's timeless. I mean, my little nephew who's, you know, 5, still loves the Muppet Show. Just plays the Muppet Show on repeat.
Yeah.
But I guess I grew up with the Muppet Show. I guess there was an influence there. But I also loved voices. I could do character voices. You know,
well, it gets back to the playground, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do that teacher.
That's right, do the teacher.
Yeah.
And I could do voice, I could manipulate my voice and, you know, be the gruff, Trekkie monster and the sort of the Ernie and Sesame Street and all that. So it sort of came quite easy to me, I guess, in that respect. And yeah,
well,
it all sort of worked out.
Got you a Heltman Award.
It did. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. And a Green Room Award.
Wow, two.
Two.
Wow.
Who'd have thought?
Yeah.
And that was a really, I mean, that was the experience, Pete. I mean, if anyone says to me today, you know, what was the experience? I say, oh, that was something else. I mean, you know, with Jonathan Biggins directing it. And
yes.
David Skelton's
Master
MD.
Of comedy. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. You know, just brilliant. It was a great time. Mitchell Butel, working with Mitchell.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time together and, you know, yeah, it was a great time.
Did Trekkie behave? He never had a sickie? He
always he's pretty good. He's pretty good. Study. Yeah, no. Well, I remember I took Trekkie with me on a drive from Brisbane to Sydney and we did go through the drive-through. Yeah, he did order some nuggets. People didn't really know how to react to that, understandably.
Mm.
But he would sometimes misbehave on radio. Because if you ever did a radio interview, it was tricky. You couldn't just go in as yourself and do the voice. Yeah, they'd insisted on the puppet.
Yeah, yeah.
So Trekkie would come in and he'd be talking in the microphone and his hands would be, you know, wandering and he'd grab you on the leg under the table. I mean, he could get away with anything. He was very naughty.
We love
very
him.
Naughty we, puppet.
We love naughty.
Yeah. But nearly killed me physically. I mean, just to hold him up for that long.
Mm.
I mean, he was a heavy puppet too. I mean, he was very heavy.
But you've got a big gun there on your right-hand side.
Well,
your
left I don't know
arm's
about that.
Not as big,
his left arm's not as big. No, exactly. That's the Trekkie arm. It's the Trekkie arm.
That's a funny thing about radio. I did a the Magic Faraway Tree for Gary Ginnivan.
Oh, right.
And played Dame Wash-a-Lot. And I did this radio interview, but I had to go in full drag to do this radio interview.
Yeah. There you go. For some reason, they just wanted the puppet there, similarly to this. I guess it helps them. To visualize who they're talking to, and
you didn't have to wear that suit of armor that you've got on today either. You
no,
just turned up in.
That's right.
Yeah, but an iconic production. Well, there's been several iconic productions that you've been. The 25th anniversary production of Les Misérables.
Mm.
That must be. A treat as an actor to sort of, I suppose you grew up with it. I mean, you'd seen Rob Guest to Les Mis.
Indeed.
So 25 years later after...
Yeah, it was something else, you know. Bamatabois and Grantaire.
Right. Put the bottle down.
Put the bottle down.
Yeah.
Which, you know, when I was one of the last to be cast, in fact. Rodney Dobson and I were the two last. Because I remember him being there, and when we auditioned for Lawrence Connor, and the next day it was all done and dusted.
Right,
it was quick as that. But it was Bamatabois was a great track, nasty track, quite a nasty character. Grantaire was very fulfilling, and great working with those lads. I guess the flip side of that is it was also the show that made me go, I don't really want to do acting anymore. You know, it was that light bulb moment in the show where I had been with the show for some time but then realised that I was sort of heading in a different direction and didn't really feel like I wanted to, you know.
You just went, you weren't getting the joy from it anymore?
I think there was a number of years there where I wasn't really extracting much joy, if I was to be honest. But I was good at it. And so, well, I was told I was good at it, so I continued on, and because it's what you know. And I did it and hung in there. But then there was a point where, you know, and for a long time, I mean, I can even remember talking to Mitchell Butel about this. And he had a similar eye to me. We'd be on stage together, but you'd always be clocking everything else around you. You'd be wandering, your eye'd be wandering, and you'd be wondering what that light was suddenly doing, and you'd notice when the light wasn't working or it sort of came up a little slower tonight than what's usual, or that set piece isn't, you know, it's usually a little bit more on stage than that. And so you were noticing things that, and so my focus was sort of always in that sort of directing world, or outside of, you know, being the actor and being behind the scenes or out the front. But, you know, I found myself, you know, in the actor world. But I was wondering whether I would be able to make the transition and how that would work. But you know, I've been acting for so long, you don't know.
Yeah.
It was a bit of the unknown, you know. I thought, well, I'm not getting the joy that I used to get, but I still love it. But I feel like I have to do something else, perhaps.
Which is great, but then how do you make that transition? How do you, you know, no one's going to give you a director's job unless you've got a few runs on the board.
Yeah.
So how do you start to develop those runs on the board?
It's hard because
you let people know, I guess.
Well, you do let people know, but I'm terrible at I'm not a particularly good salesman when it comes to myself. I don't think I don't tend to talk myself up very often. In fact, quite the opposite. But I guess you're right. I did let people know. Not that really led to much. But I guess there was. I had worked with Josh Robson in Les Mis, and Josh had come to me at a point and said, oh, you know, we've got a... You know, I directed little things here and there, Peter. I mean, you know, I directed stuff, but I remember he said, oh, yeah, I've got a show that, you know, maybe you'd be interested in having a look at it. And it was in the Heights, you know. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, you know, yeah. I mean, so we had a look at it, and of course one thing led to another, and the Hayes season happened, and then we transitioned to the Opera House, and was received very well.
Great production.
Good production. And so I guess that helped a little, and suddenly people were like, oh,
I take notice of
you. Oh, you were doing that, but now you're doing this. And there was a wonderful producer friend of mine, Mitzi Zaffer, she had been one of those people that I'd sort of said, look, I really want to make the leap. And she came to me with an offer to do a resident job on Shrek the tour, so that occurred, that happened, and we went out and did it, and then one thing led to another. So I guess you know, it's like you've got to start again, prove yourself, do the work, do it well, and that led to Cinderella, and then which I was with for over a year. And then that led to John sort of giving me a tap on the shoulder to do Grease. But I'd done a number of shows for John as an actor as well.
Mm.
So, you know, we sort of certainly knew each other.
So doing those residency gigs, did you ever have actor envy? Did you think, oh, I wish I was up there doing this? Or you'd put it to bed?
No.
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
No, not really, no. Yeah. No, I mean... It's a good question, though, because, you know, you would think that, and of course you always, you know, as a director, you always ask yourself, you know, well, you know, how would I perhaps tackle that? And I guess that feeds into some of the choices you make. But no, I wasn't ever envious or I wish it was me up there. No, never. Quite the opposite, actually. I just wanted to ensure that, you know, they all felt... you know, somewhat empowered with what they were doing, and that was my priority. You know?
It's not always the case, but you would imagine that actors make good directors because they've been there. They know what.
Well, this is true. I mean, I would
you've
have thought
been
that.
In those shoes.
That's right. Mm. I would have thought that, and I think there are certainly some cases where there isn't that.
Mm.
There are directors that have never been actors,
yeah.
And that's fine.
And similarly, you can offer great empathy in auditions. On the other side of the table.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I find auditions very stressful.
Mm.
Very stressful. As a director, very, you know, you are riding every wave that comes through the door. And so by the end of the day, you are absolutely exhausted, spent, because you know what they're going through. You know, so I tend to be very mindful of that and be as accessible and as I guess humanistic as possible.
Because you want them to do their best work. I mean,
you do. You want them to be great. Yeah. You don't want them to be bad.
No.
You want them to be excellent. You want everyone that comes through the door to get the job.
Yeah.
I remember Lynn Ruthven saying this to me years ago, you know, because Lynn was a casting agent. She said, well, everyone that comes through the door, you know, you've asked them to come in. You want them to get it. You're dying for them to get the job, you know. So there, I think there was this belief that, oh, you know, they don't like me, or she doesn't like me, or they don't want, you know, or, you know, I don't think I'll get it. But it's which is you know, fascinating to me, because you do. You want them to get it. Mm. That's why they're there. Mm. You know, you want to get it stitched up quick.
Time's money.
Yeah.
Well, that sort of answers, well, I was going to say, as an actor and as a director, what's the best advice you can give to young actors about auditioning? But I suppose it is that. Go in knowing that they want you to get the job.
Absolutely. That's definitely a big one.
Be prepared.
Right. Absolutely. Be prepared. But also, you know, I often say to young actors, and whether they listen or not, it's you know... And I think it's changed, Peter, since I was... I mean, if I was going into the business now as a young actor, I don't know how I'd go. I don't really know. Mm. Perhaps I'd go all right. Perhaps I would never work. Mm. I don't know. But I guess one thing I was able to identify as a young actor was I recognised what my unique selling point was, or what I did well, what I was able to contribute, you know, what my wheelhouse was. You know, I think a lot of actors perhaps aren't aware of that. And in Australia, we suffer from that because, you know, we only have X amount of shows going around. So we all, and understandably, we all try and fit into that box.
Yeah.
We try and squeeze into that, you know. And, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So know what you're good at. Know what your unique selling point is. And you know. Go for everything. Yes, I mean, you have to in Australia. You have to. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. You have to.
Yeah.
If you want to, you know, if you want to have some sort of career and you want to have sustainability and longevity, you've got to. But knowing what you're good at and what you cannot do is also a really good skill to have.
Mm.
But it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, you see them come through and it's like, oh, geez, you know, I remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to go to auditions, Peter, when, you know, these were overseas teams. No. Maybe some Australian teams too, but, you know. And you'd go in and you'd sing your heart out and they'd be on their phones.
Yeah.
Wouldn't even be looking at you.
Yeah.
So I always remember thinking to myself, am I ever sitting in that chair? There's no way in hell I'll be on my phone. I can tell you that.
No.
So, anyway. Yeah. You try and make it better.
Yeah.
You know. Improve it.
Well, we look forward to seeing the fruits of your labour with Grease. Melbourne, it's about to arrive in Sydney from March 24.
Yeah.
And then you're off to Perth.
We're off to Perth. Yeah. And then I think we have a little break. And then we're going into Brisbane.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So that's going to be fun.
So there's life in the old girl.
Yeah. And... So I'm working on the Grandparents Club, which is this other show that we're doing at the moment.
Oh, great, yeah.
It's quite the other end of the spectrum to what perhaps Grease is.
No, that's been written by Wendy Harm.
Wendy Harm has written the book, John Field, the music, and we've got a great cast of four. And it's very different. It's a sort of a, you know, it's a comedy review type show about, you know, being a grandparent. So it's, you know, it's the other end of the spectrum. So I'm very lucky in the sense you get to work with, you know, you've got this wonderful Grease cast. They're all young, you know, and you've got this, you know, this other show that is quite different, but
dare I say,
equally as energetic.
You're going from Greasers to Wheezers.
True. That's true. That's very good. I like it.
You can have it.
Yes. Thank you,
Luke Joslin. Thank you so much. It's been a delight to finally catch up with you and have this chat and all the best for Grease and Grandparents Club.
Thank you for having me.
Grease is the word and is presently playing to Sydney audiences with Annalise Hall in the role of Sandy alongside Joseph Spunti as Danny Zuko. You can also catch Marsha Hines, Jay LaGuire and Paddy Newton greasing the wheels of this iconic show that recalls the rock and roll of the 1950s. John Frost for Crossroads Live Australia presents Grease at the Capitol Theatre Sydney from 24th of March this year, of course, and the Crown Theatre in Perth from June. I'm Peter Eyers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.